Welcome to the next edition of our speaker series at the Patika Wealth Management Group. This is John Patika Jr., and I am joined today with Nathaniel Gabriel, who is from our Chief Investment Office, and he covers the industrial sector for us. So, Nathaniel, thanks for joining us today.
Delighted to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and we're going to continue our conversation on the 250 years of innovation. And I can imagine people think you work as a strategist focusing on industrials and it's all about quarter to quarter and what's going on with the earnings. And we're going to talk about lessons from a century or more ago. And can it be profitable to look back in order to look forward here and what's going on?
Yeah, it's a great question. And when I first started following the industrial sector some 15, 16 years ago, I had colleagues say to me, are you sure you want to cover this dying old world industry? But it's really not. I've certainly never seen it that way. And now you have industrial companies helping to power AI data centers and transform manufacturing. And as we're talking about today, pushing the boundaries of transportation. But, you know, one of the core tenets of being an industrial analyst specifically is that there's always a cycle. There's this natural ebb and flow to almost every aspect of what we look at. And the cycles can certainly look very different depending on which industry you're looking at. Some have very long cycles, like airplane manufacturing. You put in an order today and you're getting delivery in the mid-2030s, maybe. Some have very short cycles where you're just selling a widget through a distributor and they're very tied to the health of the economy, which goes through its own cycles. But the point is really that, yes, technologies change, societal priorities change, but the cycles themselves don't look all that different, whether it's today or 100 years ago, probably because human beings haven't changed all that much. So there are definitely lessons to be learned. And I think by revisiting the dynamics that led into and came out of those big historical moments, we can apply that knowledge to the trends developing today, where we have imperfect information and yet strive to make the best educated forecast we possibly can. And if you use history in the proper context to inform your approach to some of the big questions we're facing in today's markets, I think that's something that's become even more clear as we've delved back into some of these previous developments. All of them were very different situations with different funding and reasons for development, but a lot of those stock charts at those times look remarkably similar, which gets analysts like me quite excited.
Well, you wrote two really neat reports on aviation and railroads in the first industrial revolution, but we're going to start with aviation. And, you know, looking back through the history of aviation, could you talk about what were some of the big challenges when that new technology was rolling out?
Absolutely. If I boil it down, I would say the biggest challenge has been absolutely constant between the first airplane and the one that just rolled off the production line. And that's really just the laws of physics. The progress that we've made in aviation from that original Wright Flyer's 30 miles an hour to the Blackbird's 2,200 miles an hour has really just been an evolution in our own human understanding of how to best harness the laws of physics and also make progress on material science and fluid dynamics to that end. And I would say early on, it was much more about the physics, and in the modern era, much more about the material science. But throughout all of this, it's just been a highly iterative process. You engineer an idea, you test it in a wind tunnel, you take measurements, you tweak the design, and you weigh the pros and cons of various features. And in aviation, these developments really sought to solve one problem at a time. Initially, the question was, could we even have sustained, powered, heavier-than-air flight where the pilot could come out unscathed from the experience? And then, could that airplane fight other airplanes? How do you even shoot a weapon from a moving vehicle and not shoot off your own propeller? How do you use this travel to deliver the mail? How do you transport passengers safely? And now, how do you make the world smaller and travel more egalitarian and more efficient? So, you know, we're at a very interesting juncture today because there are essentially two major ways we can push the boundaries further on a modern commercial jet. You can make it more efficient, just using less fuel per mile by having the engine run hotter or blow more air, lighter weight materials, more electrification, or you can try to make it faster, which of course harkens back to the Concorde and finding ways to go supersonic without breaking windows on the ground. And you have companies working on incredibly promising solutions in all those categories. But we're also in a time where there's a shortage of new airplanes. The fleet we have in service is aging. Aircraft retirements have been delayed. I'm sure we've all flown on these ancient aircraft that are so uncomfortable. Quality control issues have grounded portions of the fleet. I'm sure airlines would love to have fuel efficiency, but my sense is we'd much rather pursue reliability at this stage, probably a little bit more averse than usual to adopting some of these future forward ideas in the very near term.
I would agree. Reliability would be my number one priority when I'm traveling. Now, let's talk about, it's interesting, there are some synergies with aviation and the military. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. The military has really been involved in aviation since the very beginning. Kind of amazing, but it was only 6 years between the Wright brothers' first airplane and the sale of what was then called the Wright Military Flyer, which was a faster plane used by the Army that came with kind of the first military contract. It was like $25,000 plus $2,500 for each mile an hour that they could squeeze out over 40 miles an hour. And then only 3 years after that, there was an Army captain that mounted a machine gun on an aircraft. So that was really the dawn of military aviation. And so the plane was originally just a tool for observation. There weren't very many planes, just a handful in the U.S. during World War I. But of course, by the end of World War II, there were over 100,000 planes built. And that's when we saw some degree of specialization. So planes built specifically to fight other planes, to drop bombs. And that really transformed aviation from what was kind of a novelty into a key domain of military operations. And we look back, there were maybe half the planes were built by the United States of 700,000 built for World War II. Today, the U.S. Air Force has a budget of $230 billion. So we've clearly scaled this up, and we continue to push the boundaries of aviation in the military today. There's the F-47 fighter jet. This is the new sixth generation that was recently awarded, and that's expected to fly alongside these what they call collaborative combat aircraft, which are essentially autonomous AI-operated drones that attack or serve as decoys. It's just pretty remarkable to think how far we've come.
Yeah, there's a really good book that Malcolm Gladwell came out called Bomber Mafia that talked about how the Air Force came about in World War II, and he goes through a lot of the growing pains on aviation and how crude it was, and bringing it up to be actually useful on their bombing runs. So that was a very good book on that, if anybody was interested in listening to that. But bring us up to today on where we're at as far as, like, I mean, there's incredible feats of like mass transit compared to what we used to have and safety. Could you just talk about like what's your most interesting in your view of what's going on as far as the progression of the safety part of the new technology of the aviation and transit?
Yeah, your point is a very good one. Air travel was very crude initially. And if we think about it, the modern aviation industry is really a marvel that's been carefully refined over the last 50 years. I think you or I don't think twice about booking a flight to visit family or go on vacation, and we'll, I'm sure, grumble about the various indignities of travel in the modern era. But when you zoom out, it's an intricate dance of 27,000 aircraft making 100,000 flights a day. It's really incredible, and very safely if you put the headlines aside and look at objective statistics. And so I think from the very beginning, the Wright brothers started off by prioritizing the safety of the pilot rather than pursuing all kinds of wacky ideas that had been tried before. And what's most amazing today is how this global industry comes together to prioritize safety. And it's not by chance that so few incidents happen. And when they do, we put out directives and processes are changed to ensure that same incident cannot happen again. We've developed in this industry what some call the Swiss cheese model. You might have small vulnerabilities here and there, but it's very rare that they all line up perfectly to go all the way through and for something to go very wrong. And certainly every effort is made to ensure they don't through procedures and redundancies and technology. And in aviation, you have to do that on a massive scale, which still boggles my mind today.
Could you talk about some of the constraints, speaking of today, that is affecting the aerospace sector?
Yeah, just given the immense complexity of engineering and building an aircraft, there are only a handful of assemblers that can do it. So, of course, we have Boeing in the U.S., Airbus in Europe. They essentially have a duopoly in larger aircraft. Embraer in Brazil is more in the smaller regional jet category. Bombardier no longer makes aircraft. They sold that business to Airbus. You know, it's a story of intense demand. If you look at backlogs, more than 14,000 aircraft worth more than $1 trillion between Boeing and Airbus alone, but a very limited ability to meet that demand. We have supply chain constraints, obviously quality control issues. So we're starting to ramp up production here, but it's a very slow, painstaking process that happens under the watchful eye of regulators. But Boeing publishes an annual market outlook that looks 20 years into the future, and they think we're going to need about 44,000 new planes over that time frame, plus 1 million cabin crew, 600,000 pilots, 700,000 technicians, really huge numbers. And for the planes themselves, the constraints are really around the supply chain. It takes more than 2 million parts to make a 787, and there are thousands of companies participating in various ways. So during the pandemic, aircraft production essentially stopped, and all those suppliers lost talent, and they struggled to get production back up. So it's something we watch closely. I would say it is improving, but there is a tight squeeze on some of the key parts like engine turbine blades that keep a ceiling on how quickly we can make new planes.
All right. So the next thing I want to talk about is this term keeps popping up a lot now, and it's called urban aerial mobility. And all I can think of is like the Jetsons and people flying just above people's houses on new roads and stuff, kind of like Back to the Future. Could you talk about this? I mean, are we even close to this?
My first thought is always the Jetsons also. And that I think that makes us all assume it's a far-fetched idea. But the reality is that this industry has matured very significantly in the last couple of years. And I do think we're likely to see some air taxis entering passenger service over the next few years. By the end of the decade, you'll probably be on an air taxi to get to the airport. But to add a little context around that, that's an idea that's made sense for a lot of reasons, but it just took time for the technology to mature enough. And once it did, small companies and prototypes really began to spring up all over the place and iterate the designs really quickly. And so quickly, in fact, that the FAA, which needs to improve every little change to airplane design, had no established framework for evaluating what's really a whole new category of civil aircraft since helicopters some 80 years ago. Until late 2024, it really meant that the industry and the FAA were learning together how to establish these operational requirements and travel corridors and pilot qualifications. But we do have this now. And it's hard to describe exactly what the end state will look like because there are hundreds of companies working on products. Some are already test flying and others are more early stage and they all look very different. But I'd say the short answer is that we're very close to the beginning of this industry starting to take off. And by the estimate of one of the leading air taxi providers, we might have 30,000 of these flying around the world 20 years from now, mostly as airport shuttles and commuters, and even transporting organs for transplant, which I've learned is a pretty high priority use case. So we're pretty close, I would say.
It's pretty incredible. I think I would consider myself a late adapter to that technology. I'm still trying to get used to the autonomous like taxi cabs on the ground and being comfortable with that. Let's switch gears here, going from the air to the rails. And one of my favorite subjects is the United States Transcontinental Railroad. And could you give our listeners just a brief history of that?
No, of course, John. Going back over the history, it really was a fascinating undertaking and truly a huge risk if we put ourselves in the shoes of decision makers back then. Before the railroad, if the Western U.S. was very lightly populated and only accessible with a very long and dangerous journey. But of course, there was also this notion of manifest destiny, that the U.S. was fated to expand across the continent, and that was worth pursuing. So there were a few years of surveys done in the early 1850s, and Congress mapped out a route that followed a good amount of the Oregon Trail as it stood then. And that was funded in 1862, which actually created the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific Railroads and laid out the financing plan. The financing was pretty innovative also at the time. The federal government issued bonds to essentially provide loans to the railroad companies, depending on the miles of track constructed, the grade of track, and the railroad companies themselves also sold stocks and bonds. And Congress granted land to the railroads, which sold bonds based on the land or sold the land directly to settlers. It ended up being about 180 million acres, so a lot of land changed hands. And the railroads got right to work. The Central Pacific Railroad started building from California. Union Pacific started building from Nebraska. And they met with the very famous Golden Spike in northern Utah 6 years later. Really an incredible achievement that the country committed to. But Of course, with many nationalistic endeavors, it had its fair share of negatives, whether it was the use of low-wage minority labor, displacement of Native Americans, or the fact that a handful of prominent businessmen oversaw quite a bit of self-dealing that made them wealthy. But just to kind of frame how transformational this was, before this, it would take up to 6 months to travel by stagecoach. That was sort of the best option. The railroad took a week, and it cost 85% less. And it also hadn't been economical to access all the natural resources in the farmland in the Midwest, because it would have cost more to haul it than it was worth. So this really opened up mining in the Rockies, and it created the American breadbasket, and at the same time allowed the flow of consumer products manufactured in the East to support all the new communities in the West. It created a lot of towns along the path, first the workers and then the settlers. And actually, we can clearly track a shift in the population center of gravity of the U.S. westward as that railroad was built. And then what I find fascinating, just some of the tangential effects. We pulled the telegraph line along the network, which drove communication. And we also, along with this, created 4 U.S. time zones, which we still use today, and more consistent timekeeping. That's a pretty remarkable side effect. And finally, while it took some time, amazingly, the railroads were able to pay off the government loans in full plus interest. So it was actually a terrific investment for the government in retrospect.
Well, when you think about that, like, technological disruption caused by that railroad, what comparisons could you draw as far as the technology disruptions that you see today, like in modern times?
Yeah, the Transcontinental Railroad in the U.S. was really the first example of the country going all in on a new technology. When it came to truly connecting a continent coast to coast, with obviously a limited number of potential use cases there, but the U.S. was a true first mover on that. It wasn't our technology for the most part. It was mostly imported from the U.K. But the key leap forward was the connecting of the coasts and the manifest destiny of settling the territories. It may have been the first time that happened, but it's absolutely not the only time the U.S. has gone all in. And you can liken it to the build out of fiber optic cable in the 1990s. And I think it's very true of the wave of AI development today. So there are some echoes of that time. When we look at the amount of capital expenditure on railroads back then, it actually got up to 6% of national GDP, which is a pretty incredible amount. There were all the same fears about disruption back then as well, not just whether carriages would be replaced, but there was also a standardization across the railroad industry, and people thought that would take jobs away from what were called transloaders, which was unpacking cargo from one train and reloading it onto another train that went on a different gauge of rail. So there's always been some degree of uncertainty around these moments of pivotal change. And then one more interesting phenomenon, which is, I think, is directly applicable today. It was actually the railroad equipment stocks that massively outperformed the broad market in the 1870s through the end of that century, much more than the railroad stocks themselves. The picks and shovels, if you will. And I think that's something we're also seeing today. We see the strong performance of the physical supply chains, electrical equipment, power generation, semiconductors and memory, et cetera.
Nathaniel, when you look at the modern U.S. railroad industry in terms of economic impact, like, is there even any opportunities for growth today or evolution in that industry? Or is this just kind of, we got the tracks on the ground and this is basically it?
Yeah, it's more of the latter. A lot of railroading is the same. We're still hauling coal, consumer goods, lumber, chemicals over long distances. It's been 157 years, so I'd say it's exceedingly mature. And if we think about the life cycle of an industry, I would say railroads are probably almost at the end state of the continuum. But it's come a long way, very consolidated. It used to be 1,500 railroads. Now we have essentially regional duopolies. They have higher operating margins than some of the largest tech companies. Some of the best railroad operators have 40% plus operating margins, which is pretty astonishing given the high fixed assets that they need to maintain. And it's a very unique business model. To your point, the networks are already built. They have very high operating leverage. Still a freight business, so it's tied to domestic economic activity. But it's kind of the perfect time to be writing on this topic because the largest railroad by market cap, which is Union Pacific, very familiar name from the dawn of all of this, is looking to acquire Norfolk Southern to create the first truly transcontinental railroad. And these railroad networks are such long-lived assets, they essentially just trade once. and that's the end of it. So we're at a very important juncture for the industry, and the Surface Transportation Board has accepted that application. They're considering it. Everyone's watching this closely, but it's a possibility that we might wind up with just two giant transcontinental railroads as a potential end state of this saga. But maybe one more little tidbit I think personally is super cool. Just after we published the locomotive report, Union Pacific is, as we speak, running a 1940s era steam locomotive across the country to celebrate the country's 250th anniversary, which I just thought was a great capstone to all of this.
Yeah, no, that's pretty cool. And I've even seen things, at least in my world over here in Tampa, people are actually wanting to ride as like a passenger on trains going up north and stuff. And I think that's kind of neat. And I think me and my family will probably end up doing that too. And it just seems like a fun experience.
Yeah, nostalgic, but it's also a great adventure.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. So I don't know if that's going to catch on or not, or that's just a little fad. But so let's talk about investment opportunities linked to transformational innovation today. And I guess as John Sr. would say, like, this is all great, but how do you make money? So could you talk about some investment opportunities that we could look at for today?
Absolutely. All of this philosophy doesn't help if we're not putting it to use. You know, I think investors often get very focused on how we've all been trained to think about portfolio allocations to equities. This sector versus that sector, growth versus value, US versus international. But, you know, if we really strip away all those categorizations, CIO's view is that a very significant component of equity market returns comes down to these moments of transformational innovation. And when we look back, at one point, there was a leap forward in the steelmaking process that made U.S. Steel the most valuable company. And then the automotive revolution made General Motors the most valuable company in the 90s. Then IBM and the computer, Apple and the smartphone, and now NVIDIA and AI GPUs. Each of these moments created a very large amount of market cap where there was very little before. But what's also interesting is that none of these names repeat. Our team's goal with this initiative is really to identify the next multi-decade investment opportunities linked to innovation and put the intellectual capital of the Chief Investment Office to work figuring out exactly where within those larger opportunities to position to capture the best economics and give them to our clients. So we've put our weight behind three key themes for the future for the coming decades: AI, power and resources, and longevity, each of which we think should lead global equity markets over time. AI, I would say, pretty straightforward theme, but it's much more nuanced than just owning the tech giants. There's a long tail of supply chain companies participating in the build-out. There are companies making applications to run on AI. And of course, there will be companies that benefit from the productivity that AI delivers. And so we want to make sure that we're capturing the right portion of that maturity cycle. And in power and resources, we just think investors significantly underestimate the magnitude and duration of the investment in the physical infrastructure that can't be disintermediated by AI in an area of real electricity demand net of efficiencies. And that theme also benefits from rising resource nationalism around the world. I help manage that strategy. And we think there's $32 trillion of spending coming in electrical infrastructure over the next decade. And this might surprise some people, but only 8% of that is linked to data centers. So it's a very broad, diverse theme that takes years and years to play out. And on the longevity side, not just about longer lifespans, it's also about longer health spans and how people living healthier for longer might change their spending habits in areas like financial services or travel or fitness centers. At UBS, our analyst team is working hard to deliver these future forward investment opportunities to our clients.
Well, you guys have some great reports on aviation and railroads and credit cards. And if any of our listeners would like to have a copy of any of those, feel free to reach out to our team and be happy to send you some. And we've also had previous podcasts where we talked about some of these different innovations that you could subscribe to the Patika Wealth Management Group on Apple Podcasts, and you can listen to those. And before we wrap up here, any last thoughts that you think our listeners, that we might have missed in our conversation, that our listeners should know?
I think just to summarize, we covered a lot of ground, but there's that old saying about history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. When delving back into these prior moments of innovation, there was a lot more rhyming than I think I would have anticipated. And so this has been a phenomenal exercise for us as well, to just realize that there have been these cycles before. The stock charts look very similar. The participants in the value chain can look very similar. And it's not just ancient history. We can directly apply this to our views of investing today. It's been a phenomenal journey examining some of these historical eras, and I'm delighted we can put it to use for the benefit of our clients.
Well, we really appreciate your time and effort on putting those together, because we find those very interesting over here. And I also want to thank you again for your time spending it with us today. I really appreciate it. Okay?
It's been a pleasure, John. Happy to help.
All right. Well, that will conclude our call for this time. And thank you, Nathaniel. And everyone, make sure to please subscribe to the Pateka Wealth Management Podcast on Apple Podcasts. And we'll talk to you later.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.